Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we discuss the lingering controversy over the former University of Illinois mascot, Chief Illiniwek. We'll hear from restaurant workers concerned about their health now that customers are coming back. Next week marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. Some of the scientific work that led to developing the bomb took place in Chicago, although not many knew about it at the time.
Secrecy was something that was drilled into everyone's minds who worked on the Manhattan Project.
We'll find out more about the role the state played in giving the world the bomb. That's ahead on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, restaurants are now offering indoor dining once again, but those who work in those businesses say they have some concerns about the risk to their health. We'll also find out about Illinois' role in the Manhattan Project. And more than a decade since it was retired, we'll hear why the University of Illinois' mascot, Chief Illiniwek, won't go away, at least for some. That and more this hour on Statewide. Up first this week, the pandemic has changed a lot of summer plans for college students, like internships, travel, jobs. Kate McGee with WBEZ tells us how some students are still trying to make the most of their summer.
Rice University student Kazalee Matthews had big plans this summer. She was going to spend 8 weeks in Argentina studying public health and working in a clinic. Then she was heading to Israel for a traditional birthright trip for young Jewish adults. All of that was canceled due to the novel coronavirus. She moved back in with her parents in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood.
So instead, I took calculus 2.
Definitely a bummer. COVID-19 has canceled many internships, study abroad opportunities, and typical fun summer plans. As colleges worry how the pandemic will affect fall enrollment, many schools in Illinois have seen a bump in summer enrollment compared to last year as students try to turn lemons into some kind of lemonade. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the University of Illinois at Chicago both saw summer enrollment numbers jump 25% and 27%, respectively, from last summer. Alina Callis is an incoming freshman at Loyola University Chicago. She decided to get a head start and take online classes this summer to get some of her general courses out of the way.
Especially double majoring, I would have to do a little bit more work, and just thinking of the future, I want to study abroad and things like that, and I just want to make time.
Loyola and other local private universities say they've seen an increase in summer enrollments too. For those lucky enough to keep their internships, it's now from the comfort of their homes. Indiana resident Joe Graziano says when the pandemic initially hit, lots of friends saw summer internships they'd secured in the fall canceled. And he was worried his paid internship with the risk management company Aon would be too. He plays baseball for Butler University and dedicated previous summers to baseball. Heading into senior year, his resume was pretty thin.
So I kind of really needed this, I'm not going to lie. So if it got canceled, my resume would have been like baseball, like a club. Not very filling.
Aon depends heavily on its interns. Traditionally, they hire nearly 2/3 every year permanently. So they mailed laptops home for interns and integrated them into teams who are also working virtually due to the pandemic. They've also been assigned group projects with other interns to help improve the company internally. Graziano says he misses the in-person interaction. It's difficult to make a good impression remotely.
There's a lot you can get from even just small talk at the office. And sometimes video calls, it's kind of hard to get across my personality as I want to. I don't know. It's hard to portray myself to you kind of over video.
Still, he feels lucky to earn a paycheck this summer. So does 19-year-old Manny Gonzalez, who is studying computer science and engineering at Harold Washington College in downtown Chicago. He was involved with the group Genesis Works in high school, which helps students in underinvested communities connect with employers for job and internship opportunities. He was able to quit an overnight job at UPS and start working at a data analytics company downtown, which he's continued remotely throughout the pandemic. Guaranteed income that's also helping him build toward his career.
I honestly feel like I'm lucky because, you know, not everybody gets this opportunity, especially like at my age. Having like these big corporate companies on my resume at my age. So it's like, you know, it's a blessing.
But even with his job, he's being extra productive this summer. He's tacked on 2 summer classes so he can finish his associate's degree early and transfer to a 4-year school to earn a bachelor's. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
In May, the Department of Education made sweeping changes to Title IX regulations. Peter Medlin with WNIJ reports on how colleges and universities are coming to terms with new policies many advocates and school officials say will chill reporting.
The new regulations change the definition of what qualifies as sexual harassment under Title IX. To meet the new standard, harassment must be, quote, severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. Shiwali Patel is the Director of Justice for Student Survivors at the National Women's Law Center.
So these rules kind of in total really just turn Title IX on its head as a civil rights law.
She says they raise the threshold of what schools can choose to ignore, and it's a departure from guidance that's been in place for around 20 years. If a student isn't being outright denied equal access to a program or activity, that might not be enough.
So that means some students would be forced to endure repeated and escalating levels of abuse before they can get help.
The new rules also require institutions of higher learning to dismiss reports of harassment that happen off campus. Now they'd have to put together a separate sexual misconduct policy to apply to those situations. This has ramifications for online harassment too, especially as many schools move to more virtual instruction during the pandemic. Faith Ferber is a student engagement organizer with Know Your Nine. She says if someone's harassing you in a class Zoom meeting, that would be covered.
But if someone is sexually harassing you over Facebook and then you have to see them in the Zoom classroom, that wouldn't necessarily be covered.
At Northern Illinois University, Title IX coordinator Sarah Garner says they do have procedures to help students.
We have the opportunity to see, okay, even though it doesn't reach this level of conduct, how are we still going to address it as a university?
But as Faith Ferber says, the problem is that places like NIU could ignore those cases if they choose to. And she says the education department isn't there to protect students either.
We can't count on our schools and we can't count on the government. So all we can count on is students and student power to really make a difference and hold our schools accountable.
At NIU, students held protests last year on the basis that the university was mishandling investigations and that the process was slow and apathetic. The university hired another coordinator, and Garner says they're much better equipped to handle their caseload now. The new regulations are over 2,000 pages, 2,033 to be exact, and the policies themselves fit into the last 30 pages or so. The reason the document is so long is so that the Department of Education, headed by Betsy DeVos, is trying to justify why the changes are needed and respond to public comments. Shiwali Patel says there were more than 100,000 comments, mostly opposing the new rules.
There were school principals, there were mental health experts, over 900 trauma specialists joined a letter and raised concern about the rule. So there was significant opposition, and yet they continued to move forward.
Sarah Garner and NIU were one of the many schools that sent in comments.
Unfortunately, not many of our concerns made it into the final regulation.
Patel says the provisions were largely unchanged from what was proposed, but there were also a few changes that weren't even in the proposed rule, so they didn't have a chance to comment. One example is that colleges and universities are now barred from dealing with complaints by people who aren't actively participating in an education program.
That means a school won't be allowed to investigate a complaint of sexual harassment if the survivor already graduated or they transferred, or let's say they dropped out of school because they were sexually assaulted and they don't plan to re-enroll.
And colleges could dismiss cases when the respondent who's being accused isn't enrolled or employed by the school. Patel says that could include a professor who retires or who resigns after abuse comes to light. Another change that wasn't included originally reiterates that the department's guidelines supersede any state law. And some of the new Title IX changes are in conflict with Illinois state law. One forces those going through an investigation to undergo cross-examination in a live hearing. And as Sarah Gardner at NIU says,
we have a state law that says you cannot cross-examine one another. This is the Illinois Preventing Sexual Violence in Higher Education Act. However, now the federal regulations say you must cross-examine each other.
In NIU's public comment, it stated that this could, quote, turn educational centers into courts of law and allow for parties to be subjected to, quote, demeaning, inappropriate, and irrelevant probing. They're waiting for the Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul to weigh in. He, along with 17 other attorneys general, is suing the Education Department to block the final rules from going into effect. Gardner says they'll find out if they have to proceed with the guidance on August 14th. There are countless other issues advocates say make the process more difficult for the people involved and for the school conducting the investigation. I'm Peter Medlin.
The former University of Illinois men's basketball coach Lou Henson has died. He was 88. He coached at Illinois from 1975 through 1996. His 423 wins are the most in program history. Back in 2015, Henson spoke with member station WILL, and he talked about being offered his first head coaching job at Hardin-Simmons University in Texas in the early 1960s.
And I said, well, I have one thing that bothers me, and I'll probably accept this job, but you'd have to do one thing. You'd have to integrate the team. I've coached black players all the time, and I'm not going to coach a total white team.
Henson led Illinois to the NCAA Final Four in 1989 and a Big Ten Championship in 1984. He was inducted into the National Collegiate Basketball Hall of Fame in 2015. That was the same year the floor at the State Farm Center was named Lou Henson Court in his honor. 13 years after the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign retired their Native American-themed mascot, the image continues to pop up everywhere, and there is some support to bring it back. The mascot officially retired in 2007 after decades of calls to get rid of the character. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom has this report.
On February 21st, 2007, thousands of people watched as a white man dressed in Native American regalia danced, high-kicked, and jumped across the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign basketball court while a marching band played. He wore a feather headdress and blue, orange, and white face paint. As the performance came to a close, the crowd cheered, and some had tears streaming down their faces.
Chief Illiniwek walks off the court for the last time at the University of Illinois.
The event was meant to be the end of a tradition which dates back to 1926, and it came after decades of calls for the university to retire the race-based mascot. But some traditions don't die easy. Today, 13 years after Chief Illiniwek was officially retired by the U of I, the symbol endures. People dressed like the mascot still pop up at games. There are Facebook groups with thousands of members calling on the university to reinstate the mascot. And merchandise with Chief Illiniwek's image is still sold.
I'm not certain that the university can move beyond Chief Illiniwek anytime soon.
That's Matthew Sakayastua Gilbert. He spent 13 years as an American Indian Studies professor at the U of I and now heads the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona. Sakayastua Gilbert saw Chief Illiniwek perform at a football game in 2006. A woman next to him asked what he did. Then she asked if he was an Indian.
And I said, I'm Hopi Indian from northeastern Arizona. And I always remember what she told me. She says, why don't you go down there and be the chief? And, you know, then everything will be okay.
By that time, the chief had become an extremely divisive issue on campus. The university was fighting to retain the mascot while the NCAA was pressuring institutions to get rid of racist Native American imagery. Debbie Reese is a Pueblo Indian who taught at the university at that time. She's an expert in Native American imagery in children's literature. Reese remembers protesting the chief outside football and basketball games.
We would go to silent protests at the games where you do put yourself at risk of being spat upon, of being yelled at, of being cursed at. Those were always very uncomfortable things, but we felt important, so we did them.
Reese says the chief is a misrepresentation of Native people.
The honoring that people say they do with mascots like this is not honoring. It's denigrating. It's demeaning. And it's an insult.
The intent of Chief Illiniwek was to hold a culture in reverence and encouraging people to learn about it.
Dan Maloney was the last person to officially portray Chief Illiniwek on that University of Illinois basketball court back in February 2007. He was a graduate student then. Maloney says the reverence Chief fans have for the character is one of the reasons it has endured long past its official retirement.
When that's removed, especially when it's such a strong source of inspiration to many, many people over many, many years, it can be tough to move forward.
And many who oppose the chief say the university is to blame for its continued presence because nothing ever replaced it.
It's basically, for a lot of people, still the mascot of the University of Illinois.
That's Vikram Sardana. He graduated from the U of I last year, and he served on a commission intended to heal the Chief Illiniwek divide. Sardana says the university should have created a new mascot years ago.
And I think that the lesson people should take from this is that not acting can make a problem worse than it needs to be. That at some point, you have to rip the bandage off.
A spokesperson for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign says that administrators are working on a plan to move the campus forward, which will include a process to establish new traditions. But Matthew Sakaya Stua Gilbert is skeptical that a new mascot can end the years-long controversy. And he says that's because of all the alumni and fans who still cling to Chief Illiniwek.
I think this will continue to be a controversy. This will continue to be a burden on the university, especially the native students who have to deal with this on a daily basis who are enrolled at the university.
Sakaya Stua Gilbert says time may prove to be the ultimate solution to the Chief Illiniwek problem. As years go by, there will be fewer people who remember when a white man in a feather headdress and face paint danced across the university's basketball courts and football fields at halftime. I'm Lee Gaines.
Staying on the sports theme, the head of the Illinois High School Association says much of the upcoming sports season remains fluid as it tries to protect against the spread of COVID-19. Executive Director Craig Anderson says the IHSA has moved football, boys soccer, and girls volleyball from the fall to the spring. He says if COVID cases rise in the fall, more sports could get shifted to the spring and winter sports could be put in jeopardy. Well, stay with us next on Statewide. You might be itching to go somewhere after months of staying at home. We'll have some tips for staying safe if you decide to vacation during the pandemic. Back on Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, as we near the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombs being dropped on Japan, we'll learn more about the work done in Illinois that changed the world forever. After spending months isolated in homes, some are wondering if it's possible to take a vacation safely during the pandemic. Shayla Farzan spoke with an infectious disease specialist, Dr. Christelle Abudo, about ways to stay safe during the summer travel season.
It's inevitable that psychologically people are tired and it's only natural to want to get away and go out. The first step is really how much risk am I willing to tolerate? And that has to do with our own health conditions, but also the health conditions of the people around us. So even if we get sick and we have mild, you know, cold symptoms and muscle aches and we get better, can we potentially take that back to somebody who may not fare so well?
So based on what we know now about the virus, are there some forms of travel that are safer than others? Like, is it safer to drive somewhere instead of flying?
I don't know that we can necessarily say one is less risky. It's the environment really that determines that. Because if you're going to do a road trip, for example, and have a bunch of other people with you in a big car, then it defeats the purpose. And I know, for example, when we talk about flying, a lot of airline companies, actually most of them have had requirements in place for mask wearing and they do health screening. But the risk of flying with people that we don't know is higher than the risk of driving in our car with people that we do know and that we live with.
A lot of families are planning to take road trips this summer. What kinds of precautions should they take?
If they're really going to a place that has lower cases, to make sure that they're not taking the infection with them. So one of the best ways to do that is the 2 weeks prior to traveling, making sure that they themselves quarantine themselves as much as possible. So watching where they're going, staying in close quarters as much as possible to, again, avoid the risk of them getting infected and then taking that infection where they're going. The shorter distance you have to travel, the better, especially if you're a family with young children. You have to think about rest stops. You have to think about, you know, bathroom breaks and where you're going to be taking those, and also stopping to eat, right? Can you bring your own food potentially, or limit yourself to drive-throughs or outdoor spaces? But what I see is really for families traveling and how many stops they have to make along the way, again, increasing the chances of them getting exposed to other individuals who may be infected that they can keep track of over time.
What about hotels? You know, I've heard some recommendations that you should be sanitizing things and, you know, stripping off the comforter when you arrive because it's less likely to be washed. You know, what about that?
So I would definitely recommend wiping down commonly used surfaces, like doorknobs are always something that get touched. Counters, spaces, high touch surfaces definitely should be cleaned. Other things that people may forget to clean are telephones that come close to the face. TV remote also is something that people don't think about. As far as the bedspread, I don't know that I have personally seen evidence that bedding or cotton fabric surfaces retain the virus. But I do know for surfaces, hard surfaces and highly touched surfaces, that that's something that can be cleaned and wiped down to limit the exposure or the risk.
We've seen cases increasing again across the country. Is that something that people should be thinking about when they're deciding when or where to travel?
Definitely look at being flexible in your timeline, also being flexible in your potential final destination, avoiding busy places, crowded places, especially places that have the incidence or the rate going higher would be recommended at this point. The things that I've seen work for people a lot is if you can do more secluded areas. So for example, going to small resorts or cabins in the woods or things like that, where they are not necessarily popular destinations or they're destinations that don't cater to thousands of people.
That's Dr. Christelle Ubudo, and she spoke with Shayla Farzan. You might wonder why it could take a while to get your COVID-19 test results. Governor J.B. Pritzker says the state has done a good job at increasing the number of tests being performed, but he says he's worried about the laboratory capacity to analyze those tests. He points out Illinois has only 3 state-run labs, which can handle about 6,000 to 8,000 tests per day. Since about 40,000 tests are being performed on a daily basis, commercial labs, both in and out of state, are being utilized.
At labs across the nation, there are only so many machines. There are only so many technicians who can run those machines for so many hours during the day.
Pritzker says commercial labs are being overwhelmed with tests from states that have seen big spikes in coronavirus cases. The end result could be longer wait times for results, which the governor points out will make it harder to determine outbreaks and take quick action. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family as the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Well, next week marks the 75th anniversary of atomic bombs being dropped on Japan. It's one of the most controversial decisions in U.S. history. Research that resulted in the weapons of mass destruction took place at several locations, but Chicago became one of the main science centers. I spoke with writer Tara McClellan McAndrew about the work done in the state and the reasons Chicago was a Manhattan Project site.
Well, there were several reasons. One was it was the home of Arthur Holly Compton, who was a physicist who was already working on some of this. Chicago was also seen as centrally located in the country so that other Manhattan Project scientists around the country could access it fairly readily. Also, the University of Chicago approved of being a Manhattan Project site and supported it.
This work going on, people unaware of it in a very busy location in a major city, it seems kind of dangerous.
It does, doesn't it? It was a secret project, and secrecy was something that was drilled into everyone's minds who worked on the Manhattan Project. There have been some oral histories taken of people who worked on the project, and one was of William J. Nicholson, who helped create the pile, as it was called. That was what became the nuclear reactor that developed the first self-sustaining nuclear reaction at the University of Chicago. And he talks about this need for secrecy and how it was drilled into all of the staff there.
There were known agents of the German government in and around the University of Chicago. And we were told that, and that we were not to reveal anything of what you do. Don't take up with strangers. If you're having a sandwich someplace or a beer or whatever, watch out that people who may engage you in conversation would be damaging to the war effort, and that they may actually be the enemy.
So one huge question that comes up about this Manhattan Project site at the University of Chicago in the middle of this metropolitan site is, was there a danger? Was there a danger to the university, Chicago, Illinois, even the Midwest region? And the physicists I spoke to said, in essence, no. The nuclear reactor that the scientists were developing at Chicago was very low powered in comparison to what we see today. At most, it could have powered a 200-watt light bulb. Therefore, it was not putting out the kind of radiation that one of our nuclear reactors today could do, and therefore the harm was not significant. Now, there was some danger to the people who were in the room where that nuclear reactor was working. One of the dangers, although the scientists in charge had done innumerable calculations to make sure the danger was very small, there was still a worry that the nuclear reactor could get out of control. And they took protection against that, and they had what they called the suicide squad, 2 to 3 men who stood atop the nuclear reactor with a cadmium solution so that in case it did run away and start to melt down, they would pour this over the pile and hopefully it would stop. But as one scientist told me, the suicide squad would not live to tell about it.
The first nuclear reaction took place there, and it was momentous, you know, especially when you think about it in the terms of what would come later. But at the time, from what I read in your story to those folks, it was sort of matter of fact.
It was a big deal, but their reaction was a bit anticlimactic. They basically broke out a bottle of Chianti and all signed the basket that the bottle of Chianti was in, and that was pretty much it. The physicists I talked to said that the lead scientists on the reactor, Enrico Fermi, was so sure he had done endless calculations. He carried his slide rule around with him. For those who don't know what a slide rule is, that was your pre-computer calculator in the days. And he carried that around with him. He did endless calculations to make sure he knew what was going to happen with this nuclear reactor. And so it went exactly as planned. And in essence, while it was an enormous event, it changed our lives. It changed science and international relations forever. The scientists there just pretty much congratulated each other and broke out a bottle.
Were the scientists concerned about the use of this technology going forward? I mean, from the time they were working on this, had they had some idea in their mind that they could be unleashing something that they will never be able to put back in the bottle, so to speak?
The folks I talked to said that the scientists, of course, are smart people. These were literally some of the greatest brains of the 20th century, scientists at the top of their field. They knew the potential of the science that they were working on, and did they know immediately that they were working on a bomb? It's kind of unclear. They certainly became aware of it as their work went on during the Manhattan Project. And after it became clear that there would be a bomb developed from their work, some of them became very concerned about that, some of the Chicago scientists especially. And they developed the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists of Chicago to work on trying to control the use and thoughts and opinions about this new power they had unleashed. After the Met Lab in Chicago achieved its goals of creating plutonium and creating the first self-sustaining nuclear reactor, both of which were essential for developing atomic bombs for the war purpose, some of the scientists continued the work on the possibilities of this new nuclear power, specifically some of the peaceful purposes of it. And they continued that work at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont, which still exists and still works today.
We talked about the concerns that something could go wrong, possibly, maybe be dangerous to people around it. At the same time, there was also concerns that the Germans, especially, would find out that this work was being done there in Chicago, could become a target during the war. That is something that was drilled into people as well.
Yes. In fact, some of the Chicago scientists working on the Manhattan Project were refugees from fascist Europe. And I spoke to a physicist who wrote a book related to the Manhattan Project. And he talks about how they had feared that the Nazis would bomb Chicago specifically because of the work and because of the refugees there.
Here's physicist Stanley Wirt.
They felt quite rightly that the Nazis basically wanted to kill them.
Right.
In fact,
right.
I found an interesting little note in the Argonne archives many years ago. It said, in effect, of course, the Germans must know we're here, so when they have an atomic bomb, the first one they'll drop will be on Chicago. Mm. That was the risk that they foresaw to Chicago area, that the Germans would drop an atomic bomb on them.
So we know that people high up in the military, I'm guessing, would have known about all of this work, and you know, the president's administration maybe would have known about what was happening here. Mm. Did everybody at the University of Chicago, even the administration there, know what was taking place?
The Manhattan Project was extremely secret, ultra secret. I've read in one place that even Truman didn't know about it, which I have a hard time believing, that Congress didn't know about it. Again, I haven't verified. And the big question, even today, is did the University of Chicago president, Robert Hutchins, know what was going on in his own backyard, almost literally, beneath his football stadium? And it sounds like there's a lot of disagreement about that. Now, I have since read the Robert Maynard Hutchins, A Memoir by Milton Mayer, and he says he absolutely knew about it, but was under instructions that when he told his deans and trustees, number one, he could not even mention the word uranium, and that when they asked him if there was any danger to the university or city, he said unlikely, but he couldn't rule it out. Now, here's what a physicist at the University of Chicago, a current physicist whom I interviewed, said about whether or not he thinks the president knew.
He had to know. It was only two blocks from his house. Historians can debate it, but I'm sure he knew about it. He just couldn't officially know about it because you can't, as I said, you can't ask, can I make a nuclear chain reaction on your campus in the middle of the city? And the answer is, heck no.
That physicist is Dr. Henry Frisch, and his story is very interesting because he is literally a Los Alamos baby. His parents worked on the Los Alamos project, and that's where he was born.
Today, there is a monument that's at that site that recognizes that work. Talk about that, and is it something that people on the campus pay a lot of attention to or remember that this took place there? Is this just something of the past that people have mostly forgotten?
That's a great question. Yes, there was a sculpture placed atop the site where the nuclear reactor was. It's right next to this beautiful new library they have. And the sculpture is very abstract. It looks like a nuclear mushroom cloud. Some people says it looks like a human brain. I think that was intentional on the sculptor's part. And When I interviewed Dr. Henry Frisch, again, a physicist currently at the University of Chicago and literally a Los Alamos baby himself, his parents worked at Los Alamos, he said that the University of Chicago has kind of split feelings about being the site of the first self-sustaining nuclear reactor in the world. He says that they have celebrated the 75th anniversary of that nuclear reactor going critical, but that there are some people who feel very uncomfortable about it because of course, how that power ended up being used and what it has done today to our international relations and potential of war.
That's writer Tara McClellan McAndrew. You can read her story about the role Illinois played in the Manhattan Project. That's available at her website, statewideshow.com. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Coming up, what it's like to be a contact tracer. That's on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, you might have concerns these days about going into a restaurant to eat. Well, it turns out a lot of restaurant workers have concerns as well. We'll hear from some of them. That story is on the way. Last week, we told you about the Reverend C.T. Vivian, who recently died. Macomb paid its final respects to the civil rights leader who grew up in the Western Illinois community. He was 95. Rich Egger has this report on the local memorial service.
More than 100 people attended the outdoor service held on a hot and muggy July afternoon. Dr. J.Q. Adams was the featured speaker. He's a former professor at Western Illinois University, and he conducted several lengthy interviews with Vivian. Adams recounted one of Vivian's best-known moments from the American Civil Rights Movement. Vivian was in Selma, Alabama in 1965 to push for voting rights. He was stopped on the steps of the Dallas County Courthouse by Sheriff Jim Clark, who punched Vivian in the face in front of reporters and protesters.
"We still see you struck and bloodied, knocked to your knees, and we still see you rise up, not with contempt, but with love, because, as C.T. says, it takes radical love to overcome radical evil."
Adams says he visited with Vivian 3 years ago. He says right up to the end, the Reverend's passion for the civil rights struggle remained alive and well. The service took place at the site of C.T. Vivian's boyhood home. The lot is now vacant, though there are plans to build a center of civic and social engagement as well as a small park at the location. Rich Egger reporting.
The federal government has paid billions of dollars to keep the food chain running. That's included, in part, sending direct payments to farmers and ranchers. But as Dana Cronin reports for Harvest Public Media, not all farmers are seeing those benefits.
When you walk into Cindy Ash's barn, one of the first things you notice, besides the sheep, is a huge burlap sack practically bursting at the seams with wool.
If you look at that big bag right there, we're sitting on about 600 pounds of wool from when they were sheared last, and it's been sitting there since they were sheared in March.
Ash runs Jubilee Farms in Clinton, Illinois, where she grows fruits and vegetables and raises sheep for wool to be turned into yarn. But not many people are buying premium yarn in this economy. Not to mention, the mill only recently reopened.
But there's really no point in us paying thousands of dollars to process wool that we can't move right now. So, which is part of what the CFAP was hoping to help with.
CFAP, that stands for Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, and is run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's meant to bolster the food supply chain, in part by providing $16 billion in direct payments to farmers and ranchers. But it hasn't been helpful to farmers like Cindy Ash.
It doesn't seem like the program was designed for produce farmers. It seems like the program was really designed for corn and soybean or large livestock producers, and we don't do any of that.
In addition to wool, Ash usually sells produce at the local farmers market, which was closed this year due to the coronavirus. So she was hopeful until she opened up the assistance application, which requires you to list each crop you grow and an estimated loss.
If you're listing every crop that you weren't able to sell at a farmers market this year, you literally, it depends how big your farm is and how much you're growing, but you could have hundreds of crops here to list.
The USDA recently added to their list of eligible crops, but some of the items ASH sells still don't qualify, including things like eggs. And for those that do qualify, USDA pays wholesale commodity prices. Usually, ASH says she could sell the wool in her barn for about $10,000. USDA would only compensate her about $200. Sanaz Arjemand is the federal policy director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. She represents a lot of specialty crop growers.
The details of how it's laid out make it hard for them to see an amount of funding coming out of the program that really covers what they need for the time that they'd have to put in to calculate all of those things and have all the paperwork to back it up.
In 2018, specialty crops accounted for about a quarter of all U.S. crop receipts. But as of late July, specialty growers received only 3% of total payments. The vast majority has gone to large livestock, dairy, and corn and soybean producers. USDA's Farm Service Agency Administrator Richard Fordyce says it's a matter of timing. That is, he says the program is based on losses incurred between January and April.
That was not really a time when we saw, you know, every state would have had specialty crop production happening at that time. So I think that's one reason why we're seeing a little smaller percentage.
Recently, lawmakers sent a letter to Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue asking him to include more small produce farmers in the program by basing it on total losses rather than on individual crops. But Fordyce says that would fail to give a full picture of what's happening on a farm. Cindy Ash says farmers like her are often overlooked by the USDA.
I would say that not just this year, but overall, they need to pay much more attention to diverse farmers, produce farmers, people that are doing something other than traditional ag like corn, beans, and large livestock.
She says it's more than likely she'll take a loss this year, a year she'd hoped to help her community get through the pandemic by providing healthy local food. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
This is Statewide. Governor J.B. Pritzker's Restore Illinois plan highlighted contact tracing as a key part of the state's fight against the novel coronavirus. Peter Medlin talked to a newly trained contact tracer about what goes into the job.
Randall Jaffe was one of the millions of Americans laid off due to the COVID-19 pandemic. He needed work, but he's also at high risk.
I'm 61 years old. I'm actually a renal transplant recipient, so I have a suppressed immune system.
Going out in public or to an office was out of the question. But then he stumbled onto an article about Illinois community colleges offering courses to become a contact tracer from home.
It interests me because I'm a people person, so I'm going to be able to talk to people, but I'm also, you know, going to be able to help people, which I think is a good thing.
Governor J.B. Pritzker seems to agree with that last part. He's called contact tracing, quote, arguably our most sustainable tool to contain coronavirus. Jaffe enrolled in a 4-week course at College of DuPage, and due to student demand, the college even had to open up extra sessions. He's just finishing, so he's in the process of looking for employment, which he says will be the easy part since the job is in such high demand. Some local health departments, like in Cook County, are offering positions starting at $20 an hour. Jaffe says he's seen jobs offering between $35,000 and $50,000 a year.
I'm not going to buy my second yacht working this job, but, you know, it'll put food on the table and keep the roof over the head, so I'm pretty happy with it.
The work of a contact tracer has been likened to a detective or a game of Clue, but Jaffe says he sees it much differently.
Typically, you're going to call someone up, they've recently tested positive, and or they've been in contact with someone who tested positive, and it could be, you know, kind of scary.
He sees himself as more of a resource than a private eye.
You then calculate their date of infection as the standard is 2 days prior to the first symptoms appearing.
He says depending on the symptoms, they'll know if they have to self-isolate or seek medical attention. And the contact tracer's job is not only to ask people about where they've been and who they've seen, they also need to direct them to any medical help or social services they might need. Tracers have to be able to break down information about the virus and dispel any myths or rumors floating around the internet. If the person needs to quarantine and are on their own, tracers can also help coordinate food for them or laundry and housing. For those perceived to be at higher risk, a contact tracer may follow up with a person every other day or in certain cases just once a week. And sometimes people are just hesitant to talk at all.
you need to develop some sort of a relationship with this individual, because the other part of it is they need to give you truthful information.
Illinois Public Health Director Ngozi Ezike acknowledges that, and she stressed the importance of the state's collaboration with community groups. Ezike says the groups may be able to reach people at risk who are uncomfortable talking with health officials. Contact tracing has been pushed into many people's vocabulary lately, but it isn't new. Public health workers have been doing it for decades to combat infections like tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases, but it's just not normally done on this massive a scale. Right now, Illinois has 1,600 working contact tracers and is looking to hire more than 4,000.
A viable employment opportunity for years, and then after, you know, I'm being positive. Hope that 4 years from now we've kind of licked the COVID thing. There's always going to be need for contact tracers, just not quite in the volumes that we need now.
And Governor J.B. Pritzker just announced that the state is pumping more than $200 million into contact tracing efforts for local health departments and those community organizations. I'm Peter Medlin.
Restaurant workers have been thinking a lot about customers. While most rely on tips, many are also concerned about how those coming to eat might be threatening their health. Vivian McCall with member station WBEZ in Chicago has this report.
One restaurant worker says every time a customer walks through the door, she feels a flash of anger.
No matter who they are or what they're ordering, every person who comes into the restaurant, I see them as a potential threat.
She doesn't want to be identified, so WBEZ had an actor re-record what she said. She says she used to love the job that now makes her sick with anxiety. She constantly reminds people to wear masks, while hers helps to conceal her true feelings.
I really think the people who go out to the restaurants now are the people who don't care about everyone's safety.
Some service industry workers say they're facing an impossible choice. They're being ordered to work inside where they fear for their health, but they could get fired if they say no. And because their bosses have asked them to come back, they can't get unemployment either. On the other side, some restaurant owners say without indoor dining, they couldn't survive. What this comes down to is really money and risk. Owners, workers, this economy need the money. But are we putting servers' health at risk? While other states have attributed COVID-19 surges to bars, doctors like Benjamin Singer at Northwestern University say it's unclear how safe restaurants are.
There's so many different layers to this, down to the individual people who would be in the restaurant, what's the setup of the restaurant, what's the airflow situation like. And so all these things create a very muddy picture as to the actual risk.
A recent Japanese study found you're 20 times more likely to catch the virus indoors than outdoors. A Chinese case study showed how the virus spread on the air currents created by air conditioning in one restaurant. Data isn't great for tracking whether restaurant workers are getting COVID-19 more than anyone else. But Governor J.B. Pritzker says if cases go up much more, indoor dining and bars could be the first to go. Lori Lightfoot just tightened the city's restrictions on bars. They can no longer serve alcohol indoors without a food license. One chef doesn't think that's enough. An actor is replacing his voice, too.
I'm not a business owner. I'm not going to pretend to know, you know, what that feels like, but I am a human, and I do know from being on the employee side of it, it felt as though the business, the money, the bottom line was far more of the priority.
He says he was forced out of his job at a high-class restaurant over discomfort about working in a packed space. Many service workers who spoke to WBEZ said they think owners just aren't worried enough about workers' health. A survey from Chicago restaurant workers found 9 out of 10 workers do not feel safe under the current rules and regulations. And the city only has 50 inspectors to check for compliance with COVID-19 rules. Glenn Falstrom agrees with workers, so much so that he let his restaurant close. He ran Falstrom's Fresh Fish Market in Lakeview for nearly 7 years, but refused to put employees at risk and said so on social media when he closed.
You know, I'm not that kind of person where my business is paramount over everybody else's concern. You know, I'm not going to go home at night and put my head on the pillow. I made $250 profit today, but Susie went down sick.
He says under current conditions, restaurants can't survive much longer anyway. Michael Roper at Hop Leaf Tavern in Andersonville says he can make it through summer, but worries about fall.
I usually look forward to fall. I like fall color. I like the coming holiday season. But this year, I am in dread of November.
That's when he has to start paying back his government PPP loan, and it will be too cold to seat people outdoors. Hopleaf is making about 20% of pre-pandemic sales with indoor dining. Taking that away would be an economic catastrophe, he says. Roper says if he didn't have thousands in bills each month, He'd mothball hop leave until the pandemic was over. He says businesses like his will die unless the government stops loan and mortgage payments.
In some other nations, this has worked, but we don't have, you know, we don't have an FDR in Washington right now. We have a Donald Trump. Our country is not going to be the same if we let all of these places go.
Vivian McCall, WBEZ News.
That's all the time we have for this week statewide. Be sure to join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's episode or past episodes, you can find them at statewideshow.com. And our podcast is available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.